in the forest shade. Confronted by such monumental configurations of nature, the human eye is woefully inadequate. Who can say how many or how few of its unfolding marvels are actually seen, selected, and recorded by the four pairs of eyes now fixed in staring wonder at the hanging rock? Does Marion Quaid note the horizontal ledges crisscrossing the verticals of the main pattern, whose geological formation must be memorized for next Monday's essay? Is Edith aware of the hundreds of frail, star-like flowers crushed under her tramping boots, while Irma catches the scarlet flash of a parrot's wing and thinks it aflame amongst the leaves? And Miranda, whose feet appear to be choosing their own way through the ferns, as she tilts her head towards the glittering peaks, does she already feel herself more than a spectator agape at a holiday pantomime? So they walk silently towards the lower slopes, in single file, each locked in the private world of her own perceptions, unconscious of the strains and tensions of the molten mass that hold it anchored to the groaning earth, of the creakings and shudderings, the wandering air and currents known only to the wise little bats hanging upside down in its clammy caves. None of them see or hear the snake dragging its copper coils over the stones ahead, nor the panic exodus of spiders, grubs, and woodlice from rotting leaves and bark. There are no tracks on this part of the rock. Or if there ever have been tracks, they are long since obliterated. It is a long, long time since any living creature, other than an occasional rabbit or wallaby, trespassed upon its arid breast. Marion was the first to break through the web of silence. "Those peaks! They must be a million years old."
"A million? Oh, how horrible," Edith exclaimed. "Miranda, did you hear that?"
At 14, millions of years can be almost indecent. Miranda, illuminated by a calm, wordless joy, merely smiled back. Edith persisted.
"Miranda, it's not true, is it?"
"My papa made a million out of a mine once, in Brazil," Irma said. "He bought Mama a ruby ring."
"Money's quite different," Edith rightly observed.
"Whether Edith likes it or not," Marion pointed out, "that fat little body of hers is made up of millions and millions of cells." Edith put her hands over her ears.
"Stop it, Marion! I don't want to hear about such things."
"And what's more, you little goose, you have already lived for millions and millions of seconds." Edith had gone quite white in the face.
"Stop it! You're making me feel giddy."
"Ah, don't tease her, Marion," Miranda soothed, seeing the usually unsnubbable Edith for once deflated. "The poor child's overtired."
"Yes," said Edith, "and those nasty ferns are pricking my legs. Why can't we all sit down on that log and look at the ugly old rock from here?"
"Because," said Marion Quaid, "you insisted on coming with us, and we three seniors want a closer view of the hanging rock before we go home." Edith had begun to whimper.
"It's nasty here. I never thought it would be so nasty, or I wouldn't have come."
"I always thought she was a stupid child, and now I know," Marion reflected out loud, precisely as she would have stated a proven truth about an isosceles triangle. There is no real rancor in Marion, only a burning desire for truth in all departments.
"Never mind, Edith," Irma comforted. "You can go home soon and have some more of St. Valentine's lovely cake and be happy."
An uncomplicated solution not only to Edith's present woe, but to the sorrows of all mankind. Even as a little girl, Irma Leopold had wanted above all things to see everyone happy with the cake of their choice. Sometimes it had become an almost unbearable longing, as when she had looked down at Mademoiselle asleep on the grass this afternoon. Later it would find expression in fantastic handouts from an overflowing heart and purse, no doubt acceptable to heaven, if not to her legal advisers. Handsome donations to 1,000 lost causes, lepers, sinking theatrical companies, missionaries, priests, tubercular prostitutes, saints, lame dogs, and deadbeats all over the world. "I have a feeling there used to be a track somewhere up there," said Miranda. "I remember my father showing me a picture of people in old-fashioned dresses having a picnic at the rock. I wish I knew where it was painted."
"They may have approached it from the opposite side," said Marion, producing her pencil. "In those days they probably drove from Mount Macedon. The thing I should like to see are those queer balancing boulders we noticed this morning from the drag."
"We can't go much further," said Miranda. "Remember, girls, I promised Mademoiselle we wouldn't be long away." At every step, the prospect ahead grew more enchanting, with added detail of crenellated crags and lichen-patterned stone. Now a mountain laurel glossy above the dogwood's dusty silver leaves, now a dark slit between the two rocks where maiden hair fern trembled like green lace.
"Well, at least let us see what it looks like over this first little rise," said Irma, gathering up her voluminous skirts.
"Whoever invented female fashions for 1900 should be made to walk through bracken fern in 3 layers of petticoats." The bracken soon gave way to a belt of dense, scratchy scrub ending in a waist-high shelf of rock. Miranda was the first out of the scrub, and kneeling on the rock to pull up the others with the expert assurance that Ben Hussey had admired this morning when she'd opened the gate.
"At the age of 5, her father loved to remember, Al Miranda threw her leg over a horse like a boundary rider.
"Yes," her mother would add, "and entered my drawing room with her head thrown back like a little queen." They found themselves on an almost circular platform enclosed by rocks and boulders and a few straight saplings. Irma at once discovered a sort of porthole in one of the rocks and was gazing down fascinated at the picnic grounds below. As if magnified by a powerful telescope, the little bustling scene stood out with stereoscopic clarity between the groups of trees. The drag, with Mr. Hussey busy amongst his horses, smoke rising from a small fire, the girls moving about in their light dresses, and Mademoiselle's parasol open like a pale blue flower beside the pool. It was agreed to rest a few minutes in the shade of some rocks before retracing their steps to the creek.
"If only we could stay out all night and watch the moon rise," Irma said.
"Now don't look so serious, Miranda, darling. We don't often have a chance to enjoy ourselves out of school."
"And without being watched and spied on by that little rat of a Lumley," Marion said.
"Blanche says she knows for a fact Miss Lumley only cleans her teeth on Sundays," put in Edith.
"Blanche is a disgusting little know-it-all," Marion said. "And so are you."
Edith went on, unperturbed. "Blanche says Sarah writes poetry.
In the dunny, you know. She found one on the floor all about Miranda."
"Poor little Sarah," Irma said. "I don't believe she loves anyone in the world except for you, Miranda."
"I can't think why," Marion said.
"She's an orphan," Miranda said gently. Irma said, "Sarah reminds me of a little deer Papa brought home once. The same big, frightened eyes. I looked after it for weeks, but Mama said it would never survive in captivity."
"And did it?" they asked.
"It died. Mama always said it was doomed."
Edith echoed, "Doomed? What's that mean, Irma?"
"Doomed to die, of course. Like the boy, who stood on the burning deck once all but he had fled. Tra-la-la-la, I forget the rest of it.
Oh, how nasty. Do you think I'm doomed, girls? I'm not feeling at all well myself. Do you think that boy felt sick in the stomach like me?
Certainly, if he'd eaten too much chicken pie for his lunch, Marion said. Edith, I do wish you would stop talking for once. A few tears were trickling down Edith's pudgy cheek. Why was it, Irma wondered, that God made some people so plain and disagreeable, and others beautiful and kind like Miranda? Dear Miranda, bending down to stroke the child's burning forehead with a cool hand. An unreasoning, tender love, of the kind sometimes engendered by Papa's best French champagne, or the melancholy cooing of pigeons on a spring afternoon, filled her heart to overflowing. A love that included Marion, waiting with a flinty smile for Miranda to have done with Edith's nonsense. Tears sprang to her eyes, but not of sorrow. She had no desire to weep, only to love, and shaking out her ringlets, she got up off the rock where she had been lying in the shade and began to dance, or rather to float away over the warm, smooth stones. All except Edith had taken off their stockings and shoes. She danced barefoot, the little pink toes barely skimming the surface like a ballerina, with curls and ribbons flying in bright, unseeing eyes. She was at Covent Garden, where she had been taken by her grandmother at the age of 6, blowing kisses to admirers in the wings, tossing a flower from her bouquet into the stalls. At last she sank into a full-blown curtsy to the royal box, halfway up a gum tree. Edith, leaning against a boulder, was pointing at Miranda and Marion, making their way up the next little rise.
Irma, just look at them. Where in the world do they think they're going without their shoes?
To her annoyance, Irma only laughed. Edith said crossly,
"They must be mad."
Such abandoned folly would always be beyond the understanding of Edith and her kind, who early in life take to woolen bedsocks and galoshes. Looking towards Irma for moral support, she was horrified to see that she too had picked up her shoes and stockings and was slinging them at her waist. Miranda was a little ahead as all four girls pushed on through the dogwoods with Edith trudging in the rear. They could see her straight yellow hair swinging loose above her thrusting shoulders, cleaving wave after wave of dusty green. Until at last the bushes began thinning out before the face of a little cliff that held the last light of the sun. So on a million summer evenings would the shadows lengthen upon the crags and pinnacles of the hanging rock. The semicircular shelf on which they presently came out had much the same conformation as the one lower down, ringed with boulders and loose stones. Clumps of rubbery ferns, motionless in the pale light, cast no shadows upon the carpet of dry grey moss. The plain below was just visible, infinitely vague and distant. Peering down between the boulders, Irma could see the glint of water and tiny figures coming and going through drifts of rosy smoke or mist.
Whatever can those people be doing down there like a lot of ants?
Marion looked out over her shoulder.
A surprising number of human beings are without purpose, although it's probable, of course, that they are performing some necessary function unknown to themselves.
Irma was in no mood for one of Marion's lectures. The ants and their business were dismissed without further comment. Although Irma was aware, for a little while, of a rather curious sound coming up from the plain, like the beating of far-off drums. Miranda was the first to see the monolith rising up ahead, a single outcrop of pockmarked stone, something like a monstrous egg perched above a precipitous drop to the plain. Marion, who had immediately produced a pencil and notebook, tossed them into the ferns and yawned. Suddenly, overcome by an overpowering lassitude, all four girls flung themselves down on the gently sloping rock in the shelter of the monolith, and there fell into a sleep so deep that a horned lizard emerged from a crack to lie without fear in the hollow of Marion's outflung arm. A procession of queer-looking beetles in bronze armor were making a leisurely crossing of Miranda's ankle when she awoke and watched them hurrying to safety under some loose bark. In the colorless twilight, every detail stood out, clearly defined and separate. A huge untidy nest wedged into the fork of a stunted tree, its every twig and feather intricately laced and woven by tireless beak and claw. Everything, if only you could see it clearly enough, is beautiful and complete. The ragged nest. Marion's torn muslin skirts fluted like a nautilus shell. Irma's ringlets framing her face in exquisite wiry spirals. Even Edith, flushed and childishly vulnerable in sleep. She awoke, whimpering and rubbing red-rimmed eyes.
Where am I? Oh, Miranda, I feel awful.
The others were wide awake now and on their feet.
Miranda, Edith said again, I feel perfectly awful. When are we going home?
Miranda was looking at her so strangely, almost as if she wasn't seeing her. When Edith repeated the question more loudly, she simply turned her back and began walking away up the rise, the other two following a little way behind. Well, hardly walking, sliding over the stones on their bare feet as if they were on a drawing-room carpet, Edith thought, instead of those nasty old stones.
Miranda!
She called again.
Miranda!
In the breathless silence, her voice seemed to belong to somebody else, a long way off. A harsh little croak, fading out amongst the rocky walls.
Come back! All of you! Don't go up there! Come back!
She felt herself choking and tore at her frilled lace collar.
Miranda!
The strangled cry came out as a whisper. To her horror, all three girls were fast moving out of sight behind the monolith.
Miranda, come back!
She took a few unsteady steps towards the rise and saw the last of a white sleeve parting the bushes ahead.
Miranda!
There was no answering voice. The awful silence closed in, and Edith began, quite loudly now, to scream. If her terrified cries had been heard by anyone but a wallaby squatting in a clump of bracken a few feet away, the picnic at Hanging Rock might yet have been just another picnic on a summer's day. Nobody did hear them. The wallaby sprang up in alarm and bounded away as Edith turned back, plunged blindly into the scrub and ran, stumbling and screaming, towards the plain. 4. About 4 in the afternoon of the picnic, Mrs. Appleyard awoke from a long, luxurious nap on the drawing-room sofa. She had been dreaming, as she often did, of her late husband. This time they were walking along the pier at Bournemouth, where a number of pleasure craft and fishing boats were tied up.
"Let us go for a sail, my dear," said Arthur.
A four-poster bed with an old-fashioned box mattress was bobbing about on the waves.
"Let us swim for it," said Arthur,
and taking her arm, dived into the sea. To her surprise and pleasure, she found herself swimming beautifully, cutting through the water like a fish without using her legs or arms. They had just reached the four-poster and were climbing on board when the sound of Whitehead running the lawnmower under the window put an end to the delightful dream. How Arthur would have revelled in the respectable luxuries of life at Appleyard College. He had always, she remembered complacently, called her his financial genius. Already the college was paying handsome dividends. A few minutes later, still in the best of tempers and determined to be gracious on this pleasant holiday afternoon, she appeared at the schoolroom door.
"Well, Sarah, I hope you have learned your poetry so that you can go out into the garden for the rest of the afternoon. Minnie shall bring you some tea and cake."
The scraggy, big-eyed child who had automatically risen from the desk when the headmistress entered was shifting uneasily from one black stocking spindle shank to another.
"Well, stand up straight when you answer me, please, and put your shoulders back. You are getting a dreadful stoop. Now then, have you got your lines by heart?"
"It's no use, Mrs. Appleyard. I can't learn them."
"How do you mean can't? Considering you have been alone in here with your reader ever since luncheon?"
"I have tried," said the child, passing her hand over her eyes, "but it's so silly. I mean, if there was any sense in it, I could learn it ever so much better."
"Sense? You little ignoramus! Evidently you don't know that Mrs. Felicia Hemans is considered one of the finest of our English poets."
Sarah scowled her disbelief of Mrs. Hemans' genius. An obstinate, difficult child. "I know another bit of poetry by heart. It has ever so many verses, much more than the Hesperus. Would that do?"
"What is this poem called?"
"An Ode to St. Valentine." For a moment, the little pointed face brightened, looked almost pretty.
"I am not acquainted with it," said the headmistress, with due caution. One couldn't, in her position, be too careful. So many quotations turned out to be Tennyson or Shakespeare. "Where did you find it, Sarah, this, ode?"
"I didn't find it. I wrote it."
"You wrote it? No, I don't wish to hear it, thank you. Strange as it may seem, I prefer Mrs. Hemans.
Give me your book and proceed to recite to me as far as you have gone."
"I tell you, I can't learn that silly stuff if I sit here for a week."
"Then you must go on trying a little longer," said the head, handing over the reader, outwardly calm and reasonable, and sick to death of the sullen, tight-lipped child.
"I shall leave you now, Sarah, and I expect you to be word-perfect when I send Miss Lumley in half an hour. Otherwise, I'm afraid I shall have to send you to bed instead of sitting up until the others return for supper after the picnic."
The schoolroom door closed. The key turned in the lock. A hateful presence swept from the room. Out in the gay green garden beyond the schoolroom, the bed of dahlias glowed as if they were on fire, caught by the late afternoon sun. At the Hanging Rock, Mademoiselle and Miranda would be pouring out tea under the trees. Resting her heavy head on the ink-stained lid of the desk, the child, Sarah,
burst into wild, angry sobs.
I hate her. I hate her. Oh, Bertie. Bertie, where are you? Jesus, where are you?
If you were really watching the sparrows fall, like it says in the Bible, why don't you come down and take me away? Miranda says I mustn't hate people, even if they are wicked. I can't help it. Darling Miranda.
I hate her. I hate her.
There was a scrape of the desk on the floorboards as Mrs. Hemmons went hurtling towards the locked door. The sun had gone down in a blaze of theatrical pink and orange behind the college tower. Mrs. Appleyard had eaten a substantial supper on a tray in her study, cold chicken, Stilton cheese, and chocolate mousse. Meals at the college were unfailingly excellent. Sarah had been sent to bed dry-eyed and unrepentant with a plate of cold mutton and a glass of milk. In the lamp-lit kitchen, Cook and a couple of the maids were playing cards at the scrubbed wooden table, capped and aproned, ready for the imminent return of the picnickers. The night gradually darkened and thickened. The tall, almost empty house, for once, had fallen silent, filled with shadows. Even after Minnie had lighted the lamps on the cedar staircase where Venus, with one hand strategically placed upon her marble belly, gazed through the landing windows at her namesake pendant above the dim lawns. It was a few minutes past 8 o'clock. Mrs. Appleyard, playing patience in her study, with one ear cocked for the sound of the drag coming up the gravel drive, decided to ask Mr. Hussey to step inside for a glass of brandy. There was still enough left in the decanter since the Bishop of Bendigo had lunched at the college. Mr. Hussey, over several years of experience, had proved himself so punctual and entirely reliable that at 8:30 by the grandfather clock on the stairs, the headmistress rose from the card table and pulled the velvet cord of her private bell that jangled with authority in the kitchen. It was immediately answered by Minnie, rather red in the face. Mrs. Appleyard, from whom the housemaid stood at a respectful distance in the doorway, noted with disapproval the crooked cap.
"Is Tom about still, Minnie?"
"I don't know, Mum. I'll ask Cook," said Minnie, who had last seen her adored Tom 30 minutes ago, stretched out in his underpants on the truckle bed in her attic room.
"Well, see if you can find him, and send him to me as soon as you do."
After 2 or 3 more rounds of Miss Milligan, Mrs. Appleyard, who normally despised the luxury of cheating at patience, deliberately dealt herself a necessary knave of hearts and went out onto the gravel sweep before the porch, where a lighted kerosene lantern swung from a metal chain. Against a cloudless, dark blue sky, the slate roofs of the college glimmered like silver. In one of the upstairs rooms, a solitary light was burning behind a drawn blind. Dora Lumley, off duty and reading in bed. The scent of stocks and sun-drenched petunias was overpowering on the windless air. At least the night was fine, and Mr. Hussey a driver of high renown. All the same, she wished young Tom could be found, if only to agree with his Irish common sense that there was nothing to worry about in the drag being nearly an hour late. She went back to the study and began another game of patience, getting up almost at once to compare her gold watch with the clock in the hall. When it struck for 9:30, she rang for Minnie again and was informed that Tom was taking a hot bath in the coach house and would be there directly. Another 10 minutes dragged by. At last, the beat of hooves on the high road, perhaps 0.5 mile away. Now they were crossing over the culvert. She could see lights moving on the dark trees. A chorus of drunken voices as the vehicle gathered speed on the flat road and passed the college gates at a fast trot. A drag load of revelers returning from Wood End. At the same moment, Tom, who had heard them too, presented himself in carpet slippers and a clean shirt at the open door. If Mrs. Appleyard had a liking for anyone in her immediate orbit, it was surely merry-eyed Irish Tom. No matter what was asked of him, from emptying the pig bucket to playing a tune on the mouth organs for the maids, or driving the drawing mistress to the Wood End station, it was all the same to Tom.
"Yes, ma'am. You're after wanting me," so many were saying.
Under the unshaded light of the porch, their heavy folded cheeks were the colour of tallow.
"Tom," said Mrs. Appleyard, looking him full in the face as if to screw an answer out of him with her gimlet eyes, "do you realise that Mr. Hussey is shockingly late?"
"Is that a fact, ma'am?"
"He promised me faithfully this morning to have them back here by 8 o'clock. It is now 10:30. How long would you say it takes to drive from the Hanging Rock?"
"Well, it's a fair step from here."
"Think carefully, please. You are familiar with the roads."
"Say, 3 to 3.5 hours. You wouldn't be far out."
"Exactly. Hussey intended to leave the picnic grounds soon after 4 o'clock, directly after tea."
The carefully modulated college voice had suddenly become raucous.
"Don't stand there gaping at me like an idiot. What do you think has happened?"
In the lilting Irish sing-song that fluttered many a female heart beside his Minnie's, Tom was soothing at her side. If the distraught face had been reasonably kissable, he might even have dared a conciliatory peck on the flaccid cheek, unpleasantly close to his well-scrubbed nose.
"Now don't you be distressing yourself, ma'am. It's 5 grand horses he's driving, and him the best coachman this side of Bendigo."
"Do you think I don't know all that? The point is, have they had an accident?"
"An accident, ma'am? Well, now, I never so much as gave it a thought. Such a fine night and all."
"Then you're a bigger fool than I thought. I know nothing of horses, but they can bolt. Do you hear me, Tom? Horses can bolt. For God's sake, say something."
It was one thing for Tom to stall and cajole in the kitchen. Quite another here in the front porch, with the headmistress standing over him, twice as large as life, with her tall black shadow behind her on the wall.
"Ready to eat me, she looked," he told Minnie afterwards. "And the devil of it was I knew in my bones the poor creature was right."
Greatly daring, he put a hand on one grey silk wrist, encircled by a heavy bracelet from which hung a blood-red heart.
"If you'd come inside and sit down for a wee while, Minnie can bring you a cup of tea." "Listen! What's that? God be praised, I can hear them now."
It was the truth, at last. Hooves on the high road, 2 advancing lights, the blessed scrape of wheels as the drag came slowly to a halt at the college gates.
"Well, dear sailor, Duchess, get over."
Mr. Hussey, talking to his horses in a voice almost unrecognizably hoarse. From the dark mouth of the drag, the passengers came straggling out, one by one into the light of the carriage lamps, fanning out onto the gravel drive. Some crying, some sodden with sleep, all hatless, disheveled, incoherent. Tom had gone bounding off down the drive at the first hint of the drag's approach, leaving the headmistress to dragoon her trembling limbs into a commanding stance on the porch. First to come stumbling towards her, up the shallow steps, was the Frenchwoman,
ashen under the light.
Mademoiselle, what is the meaning of all this?
Mrs. Appelliad, something terrible has happened.
An accident? Speak up! I want the truth.
It is all so dreadful. I don't know how to begin.
Compose yourself. A fit of hysterics will get us nowhere. And where in heaven's name is Miss McCraw?
We left her behind. At the rock.
Left her behind? Has Miss McCraw taken leave of her senses?
Mr. Hussey was pushing through the sobbing, wild-eyed girls.
Mrs. Appleyard, may I speak to you alone? I think the French lady is going to faint.
He was right. Mademoiselle, exhausted with the strains and stresses of the day, had passed out on the hall carpet. From the servants' quarters, Minnie and Cook, who had long since removed caps and aprons for a fitful sleep, had come running through the baize door under the staircase, which Miss Lumley, in a purple dressing gown and curl papers, was descending with a lighted candle. Smelling salts were produced for Mademoiselle, and brandy, and with Tom's help the governess was carried off to her room.
"Ah, the poor things," said Cook. "They look worn out. Whatever can have happened at the picnic?"
"Quick, Minnie. Don't bother asking the madam. We'll give them some of my hot soup."
"Miss Lumley, get these girls to bed immediately. Minnie will help you. Now, Mr. Hussey."
The door of Mrs. Appleyard's sitting room closed behind the broad, still, magnificent, upright, weary back.
"If I might have a drop of spirits, ma'am, before I begin."
"You may. I see you are exhausted. Now then, tell me as briefly and plainly as you can exactly what has happened."
"My God, ma'am, if only I could tell you. You see, that's the worst of it. Nobody knows what's happened. Three of your young ladies and Miss McCraw are missing at the rock."
Extract from Ben Hussey's story, as given to Constable Bumfer of Woodend, on the morning of Sunday, February the 15th, at the police station. After the two teachers and myself realised that nobody in our party had the correct time, both my own watch and Miss McCraw's having stopped during the drive out, it was agreed we should leave the picnic ground as soon as convenient after lunch, as Mrs. Appleyard was expecting us back at the college no later than 8 o'clock. The French lady arranged we should have some tea and cake after I'd harnessed up my horses, as we had a fairly long drive ahead of us. I should say it was then about 3:30, judging by the way the shadows were moving on the rock. As soon as me billies were boiling, I went over to tell the two ladies in charge that the tea was ready. The elderly teacher had been sitting reading under a tree when I had last seen her, was not there. In fact, I never saw her again. The French lady seemed very upset and asked me if I had noticed Miss McCraw walking away from the camp, which I had not. She told me, "None of these girls saw which way she went. I can't understand her not being back here on time. Miss McCraw is such a punctual lady." I asked if the rest of my passengers were present and ready to leave. She told me, "All but four. With my permission, they went for a short walk along the creek so as they could get a closer view of the hanging rock.
All except Edith Horton are senior girls and very reliable."
The three missing girls had travelled with me to the picnic ground on the box seat. I knew them quite well. They were Miss Miranda, I never heard her surname, Miss Irma Leopold, and Miss Marion Quaid. I wasn't particularly worried so far, only a bit put out by the delay of getting away. I know that part of the country pretty well, and as soon as I had the girls organised to look for them in pairs, round about the creek, on the flat, cooing and calling out as they went. About an hour must have gone by when the girl, Edith Thornton, came running out of the scrub.
near the southwestern base of the rock, crying and laughing and with her dress torn to ribbons. I thought she was going to have a fit of hysterics. And she said that she had left the other three girls somewhere up there, pointing to the rock, but seemed to have no idea in which direction. We asked her over and over again to try and remember which way they'd gone, but all we could get out of her was that she'd got frightened and she'd run back downhill all the way. Luckily, I always carry some emergency brandy in my flask. We gave her some and wrapped her up in my driving coat, and Miss Rosamond, one of the senior girls, took her off to lie down in the drag while we went on with the search. I called all the girls back and I counted them this time, and we went further afield, right up to the base of the rock on the southern elevation, trying to find Edith Horton's tracks. But they had petered out almost at once on the stony ground. Without a magnifying glass, it was impossible to see anything in the way of a footprint. None of the scrub seemed to be disturbed except for a few yards where she had come out at the open ground and started to run back towards our camp at the creek. For further reference, we marked the opening between these trees with some sticks. Meanwhile, two of the senior girls had gone off along the creek, intending to make some inquiries from another picnic party who were there when we arrived, before lunch. But they had put out their fire and left, probably while I was attending to my horses. Four people and a wagonette. I think it was Colonel Fitzhubert's, but I did not actually see any of them to speak to. Several of the girls said they had seen this wagonette driving away earlier in the afternoon, with the young fellow on the white Arab pony riding behind. We must have gone on calling and searching for several hours. I couldn't believe my senses that three or four sensible people could disappear so quickly in such a comparatively small area without some kind of tracks. And I'm still just as mystified as I was yesterday afternoon. As even the lowest and most accessible levels of the rock are exceedingly treacherous, especially for inexperienced girls in long summer dresses, I was afraid of letting them out of my sight in case they got lost themselves, what with the holes and precipices, and to my knowledge, only one overgrown track leading towards the summit, which presumably the missing persons did not take, as I made a point of looking there very thoroughly at the point where it starts. There were no signs of crushed undergrowth, footprints, etc., either here or anywhere else. As it grew later and darker, we had no means of knowing the time except by the sinking sun, we lit a number of fires along the creek in such a way that they could be seen from various angles by anyone this side of the rock. We also kept on cooing as loud as we could, singly and all together. I got the two billies and beat on them with the crowbar I always keep in the drag for emergencies. By this time, the French lady and I were at our wits' end to decide whether to drive back to Woodend with the news or go on looking. We had only the two oil lamps on the drag, and my hurricane lamp lit up a few square yards at a time. If the missing persons were still somewhere on the rock, which I had begun to doubt, without matches, they would be in real danger after dark unless they had the sense to sit tight in a cave until daylight. The French lady and some of the girls were getting a bit hysterical, and no wonder. None of us had had so much as a cup of tea since lunchtime. We were too worried to think of making it. We had some lemonade and biscuits, and I decided to take the party back to the college without looking any more that night. I don't honestly know if I did right to act as I did, but I take full responsibility for the decision. I am pretty well acquainted with the three missing girls, and I reckon that unless they had all three met with an accident, which seemed unlikely, Miss Miranda, who was well used to the bush, would have kept her head and found some safe place to shelter for the night. As for the teacher, I hope for her own sake she didn't wander off on her own. A knowledge of arithmetic don't help much in the bush.
after calling in at the police station at Wood End on the way home and briefly informing the officer on duty what had occurred at the Hanging Rock. We drove to Appleyard College without further delay. I forgot to mention that I made a careful investigation of the public lavatories, ladies and gents, situated at the picnic grounds about halfway between the creek and the base of the rock. There were no footprints or any other signs of recent use.
5. For the inmates of Appleyard College, Sunday the 15th of February was a day of nightmare indecision, half dream, half reality, alternating, according to temperament, between wildly rocketing hopes and sinking fears. The headmistress, after a night passed in staring at the wall of her bedroom interminably whitening to a new day, was on deck at her usual hour, with not a hair of the pompadour out of place. Her first concern this morning was to ensure that nothing of yesterday's happenings should be so much as whispered beyond the college walls. The three wagonettes that ordinarily took the boarders and governesses to the various churches had been countermanded before Mr. Hussey had taken his leave last night. Churches, in Mrs. Appleyard's opinion, being hotbeds of gossip on a fine Sunday morning. Thank heaven Ben Hussey was a sensible creature who could be trusted to keep his mouth shut, except for the confidential report already in the hands of the local police. At the college, absolute silence until further notice was the rule. It may be fairly assumed that it was obeyed by those of the staff and pupils still on their legs and able to communicate after last night's ordeal. At least half the picnickers had been confined to their rooms with shock and exhaustion. However, we may have our suspicions that Tom and Minnie, as natural news spreaders and possibly Cook, all of whom had unofficial visitors during Sunday afternoon, were not quite so conscientious, and that Miss Dora Lumley may have exchanged a few words at the back door with Tommy Compton, who delivered the Sunday cream. Dr. Mackenzie of Wood End had been sent for and turned up in his gig soon after breakfast. An elderly GP of infinite wisdom who, in taking in the situation with one shrewd gold spectacle glance, prescribed a whole holiday on Monday, light nourishing food, and some mild sedative. Mademoiselle was confined to her room with a migraine. The old doctor patted the pretty hand on the coverlet, sprinkled a few drops of eau de cologne on the patient's burning forehead, and observed mildly, "By the by, my dear young lady, I hope you're not so foolish as to blame yourself in any way for this unfortunate affair. It may very well turn out to be a storm in a teacup, you know." "Mon Dieu, doctor, I pray that you are right." "Nobody," said the old man, "can be held responsible for the pranks of destiny." Edith Horton, for once in her life something of a heroine, was pronounced by Dr. Mackenzie to be in good physical trim, thanks to the prolonged fit of screaming. In a girl of her age, nature's answer to hysteria. Although he was a little disturbed by her remembering nothing whatever of the thing that had sent her running back alone and terrified from the rock. Edith liked Dr. Mackenzie, who didn't, and appeared to be trying, as far as her limited intelligence allowed, to cooperate. It was possible, he decided, as he drove home, that the child hit her head on a rock. Easily done, in that rough country, and was suffering from a mild form of concussion. Mrs. Appleyard had spent the greater part of Sunday alone in her study, following a conversation with Constable Bumfer of Wood End, who had brought with him a none-too-bright young policeman for the purpose of taking notes on a relatively unimportant matter which Bumfer expected to be satisfactorily cleared up before Sunday evening.
City people were forever getting themselves lost in the tall timber and getting Christians off their beds on Sunday mornings to find them. It appeared, however, that the facts concerning the three missing schoolgirls and their governess were more than ordinarily vague. Apart from Ben Hussey's story, which did no more than sum up events already known and confirmed, Bumpher had arranged for the two young men picnicking at the Hanging Rock on Saturday, so far the last people to have seen the missing girls crossing the creek, to give the police any further information which might be required if they had not already been found on Monday. The only other person that Bumpher would like to speak to this morning for a few minutes, if convenient, was the girl, Edith Horton, who had actually been with the three of the missing persons, possibly for several hours, before she had returned, panic-stricken, to the luncheon camp. Accordingly, Edith, red-eyed, in a cashmere dressing gown to match, was brought down to the study, only to prove an inarticulate and utterly useless source of information. Neither the constable nor the head could extract anything more constructive than a sniff or two and sulky negatives. Perhaps the young policeman might have done better, but he was not given a chance, and Edith was escorted back to bed. "It doesn't signify," said Bumpher, accepting a glass of brandy and water. "In my private opinion, ma'am, the whole affair will be cleared up within a few hours. You've no idea how many people get themselves lost if they stray a few yards off the beaten track." "I wish, Mr. Bumpher," said Mrs. Appleyard, "I could agree with you. My head girl, Miranda, was born and bred in the bush. With regard to the governess, Miss McCraw..." It had already been established that nobody had seen Miss McCraw leaving the picnic party after lunch, although for some unknown reason she must have suddenly decided to get up from under the tree where she had been reading and followed the four girls towards the rock. "Unless," said the policeman, "the lady had some private arrangements of her own, to meet a friend or friends, for instance, outside the gates?"
"Definitely no. Miss Greta McCraw, whom I have employed for several years, to my knowledge, has not a single friend, or acquaintance even, on this side of the world."
Her book had already been found, with her kid gloves exactly where she had been sitting, by Rosamond, one of the senior girls. Both Mrs. Appleyard and the policeman were agreed that a mathematics mistress, no matter how smart in figures, as Bumpher had put it, could be fool enough to lose her way like anyone else, although the point was rather more delicately made. Even Archimedes, it was suggested, might have taken a wrong turning with his thoughts on higher things. All this the young policeman took down with much hard breathing and pencil licking. Later, when the passengers in the drag on its outward journey were briefly questioned, it would be recalled by several witnesses, including Mademoiselle, that Miss McCraw had been talking rather wildly of triangles and shortcuts, and had even suggested to the driver that they should go home by a different and quite impractical route. A continuous search of the picnic ground and as much of the Hanging Rock as could be clambered over and observed at close quarters had already been set in motion by the local police. One of the most baffling features, as already reported by Mr. Hussey, was the absence of any kind of tracks other than some crushed bracken and bruised leaves of a few bushes on the lower slopes of the eastern face of the rock. On Monday, unless the mystery had been solved, a black tracker was being brought from Gippsland and, at the instigation of Colonel Fitzhubert, a bloodhound, for whom certain articles of the missing person's clothing were labelled by Miss Lumley and handed over at the constable's request. A number of locals, including Michael Fitzhubert and Albert Crundall, were already assisting the police in the careful tooth-combing of the surrounding scrub.
News travels as fast in the Australian bush as it does in a city, and by Sunday evening there was hardly a house within 50 miles of Hanging Rock where Saturday's mysterious disappearance was not being discussed over the evening meal. As always in matters of surpassing human interest, those who knew nothing whatever, either at first or even second hand, were the most emphatic in expressing their opinions, which are well known to have a way of turning into established facts overnight. If Sunday the 15th had been a nightmare at the college, Monday the 16th was, if anything, worse. Beginning with a ring at the hall door at 6 a.m. by a young reporter from a Melbourne newspaper on a flat-tired bicycle who had been restored by Cook with breakfast in the kitchen and sent back, newsless, on the Melbourne Express. This unhappy youth was the first unwelcome caller of many, many more. The cedar door, rarely used except on ceremonial occasions, was opening and shutting from morning till night on a variety of callers. Some well-intentioned, others merely inquisitive, including a few male and female hyenas, drawn, quite frankly and openly, by the smell of blood and scandal. None of these people were admitted. Even the curate from Macedon and his kind little wife, both dreadfully embarrassed, but imbued with a genuine desire to help in time of trouble, were dismissed, like everyone else, with a curt, "not at home," on the porch. Meals were served with their customary clockwork precision, but only a few of the usually ravenous young women who sat down to the midday dinner did more than trifle with the roast mutton and apple pie. The seniors gathered together in little whispering groups. Edith and Blanche sniffed and slouched, arm in arm for once uncorrected. The New Zealand sisters endlessly embroidered, murmuring of remembered earthquakes and other horrors. Sarah Wayborn, who had lain awake all Saturday night, waiting for Miranda to return from the picnic and kiss her goodnight as she always did, no matter how late the hour, flitted restlessly from room to room like a little ghost until Miss Lumley, whose head was pounding like a sledgehammer, produced some linen to be hemmed before tea. Miss Lumley herself and the junior sewing mistress, when not engaged in running messages for the head and other unrewarding duties, complained, to their mutual satisfaction, of being put upon, a handy phrase which covered everyone in authority from the almighty down. The essay on the Hanging Rock, still chalked up on the blackboard as the major exercise in English literature for Monday, February the 16th at 11:30 a.m., was never so much as mentioned again. At last the sun sank behind the glowing dahlia bed. The hydrangeas shone like sapphires in the dusk. The statues on the staircase held aloft their pallid torches to the warm blue night. So ended the second dreary day. By the morning of Tuesday the 17th, the two young men who had been last to see the missing girls on Saturday afternoon had dictated their respective statements to the local police. Albert Crundall, at the Wood End station, and the Honourable Michael Fitzhubert in his uncle's study at Lakeview. Both had affirmed their complete ignorance as to the subsequent movement of the four girls after they had crossed the creek near the pool and walked away in the direction of the lower slopes of the Hanging Rock. Michael, with faltering tones and downcast eyes, which seemed to have receded into his head since Sunday morning, when Albert had come galloping back from Manasseh's store with the news of the girl's disappearance. Constable Bumfer had seated himself at the Colonel's writing table with Michael opposite, stiff, on a high-backed chair. After the usual formalities were completed, "I think, sir,"
said the policeman. "We'd better start off with a few questions, just to get the general picture, so to speak."
Young Mr. Fitzhubert, with his shy, charming